incredibly lucky because the advantage of becoming an artist is you get to reflect on yourself as a human being and how you position yourself in the world. And when you are interpreting a character, you get to go through the psyche of someone else and have a little bit more humility about the world and about human nature.
Welcome to the Act of Storytelling.
We want to debate, investigate, and entertain.
Join us as we challenge the human experience
by speaking to people who impact the world through art. Chapter 2, Podcast 2, Buddy Miller.
Hi, everybody.
I'm Lauren Bailey.
And I'm Nick Kane.
Firstly, we would like to pay our respects to elders past and present and to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet today.
Yes, and we would also like to thank the fantastic team who have helped us shape Chapter 2 of the Act of Storytelling podcast. So that includes Anita Quayle for composing and performing the beautiful new music for the podcast. It includes Colin Wynn at 30 Mil Studios for mixing and mastering the said music. Jennifer Piper at Piper Does for our new website design. And Marion Garanou for logo design advice. And of course, Michael Ladson at Noisy Street Design for the sound edit.
And, of course, if you're excited that the podcast is back for another chapter and would like to help support us, please feel free to head over to Patreon and support us for as little as a dollar a month.
Please do, please do, please do. Look, let's get straight into this month, Lauren Bailey, or the Bailey Bailster.
We're not getting any cooler.
Not at all. What exciting things have you been up to this month?
Well, it has been an exciting month.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, tell us about it. What's?
It feels like a big month. It feels like a long time.
You were very unsure then about your month.
Yeah, it just feels like, I think it feels like a long time since we've recorded. So
yep.
Good things have been happening. Booked a TVC.
Fantastic.
Booked voiceover for another TVC. Mm-hmm. I've been submitting the film for festivals. Just after we last recorded, I was very lucky to head up to Sydney. Well, I was up in Sydney with you.
Yes, I was there.
Supporting Sally Story for her feature film that she co-produced, That's Not Me, that
yep.
screened at the Sydney Film Festival. And which, really excitingly, I think it's September 7th. It's going to screen at MIFF. And then September 7th, it's released at Palace Cinemas.
Fantastic.
And the protagonist of the film is an actress, and she has a twin sister who is also an actress whose
yep.
career is really starting to take off.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's clever and
yes.
funny, and the acting's really spot on, and there are familiar faces in there, and there's definitely, for people who are actually in the industry, some moments feel like that is just too close to the bone.
It sounds great.
Yeah, so that was an exciting little bit mid-month. What else have we been doing? Getting back into classes.
Mm-hmm.
I've just started the American Reel class with Chad O'Brien,
mm-hmm.
who people will remember from podcast 20-something or other.
20-something. There's that many podcasts now
Emily
that we actually
Wills.
Don't. We can't just go podcast 2 or 3.
We can't just reel them off.
It was somewhere in the early 90s.
But, we've just had our first class last week, and it's looking at American dialect, which
yes.
I haven't formally touched on for some time, and with a new approach with a background in Dudley Knight's work, and mm-hmm. Chad's a Fitzmaurice voice accredited teacher.
Yes.
He is fantastic. And at the end of the course, we will film something.
Wow.
In American. So yeah, so that's
cool.
Nice to be back in a class.
Yeah. And with Chad.
Yeah.
You
well,
know,
yeah, he's okay.
What a champion.
Yeah.
Fellow ginger.
Yeah, Chad's awesome. Yeah. It's just interesting when you say, how's your month been? And looking back, I think I felt productive, but also, I had a birthday.
What you did.
That's productive.
Well, happy birthday, although I said that to you on the day.
Yeah, on the actual day, yes.
Yep.
So you're still a friend. You're still on the friends list.
Just.
I think I've just felt the sort of energy of winter. Like, I love winter.
Mm.
It's been beautiful in Melbourne, really cold and blue skies. But it's a different energy.
Okay, describe that.
I think
do you go insular? Is that what you're saying? Or is it or inwards?
What? Well, I think that's the challenge, isn't it? Because I think you do go inwards during winter, but you still need to live life and you still have things you want to achieve. So,
well, yeah, seasonality, I was about to say, is a big thing in Japanese culture. Generally, a lot of their art is based around what season they're in. So, for instance, you will get, if it is sort of autumnal, they'll get a lot more of those kind of colours that come through in autumn in Japan. Yeah. So it's like it affects their art. So much.
And you
like
also see that in their art. You know, if someone's mood changes, then quite often if it's a film, like the scenery will change season just to match.
Well, that's part of the geisha stories. Usually they follow the seasons as well. So there's a sort of linear story. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So you are experiencing that. Much like the Japanese like to experience.
Yeah, it's been a Japanese month for me. You know.
There you go. Well, that sums it up, a Japanese Australian month way.
But yes, speaking of the way that seasons can affect us, how's your month been?
Oh, I actually wanted to talk about a particular topic today, one that's been consuming me a little bit this month.
Yeah.
And I don't want this to come across as sort of me. I just want to put this out there in the hope that some other people that might be feeling the same get some benefit out of it. And it's a little story, so bear with me really quickly.
Always.
So I went to the... Thank you. I went to the doctor a couple of weeks ago, and I went to go get a new mental health care plan, which I don't mind sharing. That's part of life. You must go and see people to talk about things whenever you can. It's a big part of being an artist, I think, being able to find the catharsis in some ways. And I went to the doctor and they make you fill out a form. I don't know if you've ever seen the form. It's basically a 0 to 10 form and they ask you a heap of different questions. At the end, you basically collect all the numbers and it adds up to a certain number and it says on the scale of depression and anxiety, where are you sitting from that particular message?
Please turn the page.
And so I did this, right? No, this is not the first time I've done this, but I was very surprised to find that I actually registered for severe anxiety.
Oh.
It was quite a shock at the time, but I realized probably a little bit that I was actually fighting that, which is a strange feeling. Like I didn't, you know, you kind of be this tough guy and you get along with things, but then you realize that, and I just wrote a quick list of the things that I was experiencing, like a complete paralysis around next steps for what to do at work, a 2 a.m. waking up and worrying about things, using my phone as an escape at night to help me go to sleep, to withdrawing from social functions, seeing the difference in me at social functions, not being able to meditate for longer than 10 minutes, right, which is a scattered brain, which is a huge part. So this imbalance in my life I really felt, and it was really interesting. First of all, I want to say I'm completely okay. This is just one of the things you deal with, right? But I did also notice that I was trying to fight those things, going, well, bloody hell, I should be waking up at 2 a.m. and doing these things. And, you know, all these things that were slowly building up that were the kind of the signs. I was fighting it rather than thinking about the ways that I can mitigate.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting. And I wanted to share this because I think anxiety is one of these things in Australia that we actually don't talk about as much. We talk about depression a lot, but anxiety is a completely different thing. And you actually, if you look at the figures, there's around about 2 million Australians who suffer from some form of anxiety. That's nearly 10% of our population. I did want to say that anxiety is really around the stories that we tell ourselves sometimes, you know, the things aren't necessarily okay or, you know, or they're not okay, full stop. And I think one of the things is we have to shape that story. So it's not about directly fighting, and there are ways you do it, but there are ways you can mitigate anxiety. So think about things like limiting coffee, making your bedroom a phone-free zone, and talking, which is why you go to people and professionals.
I mean, obviously, while we're talking about this, you know, talking to professionals is a really important thing, but also being able to talk to people around
you. 100%. And I think there is a line with this, personally. And
feeling like, you know, like, I think this is fantastic that you're bringing this up now. And in some ways, I guess I'm a little alarmed because I'm like, oh, I was sort of aware of some of that. So,
Yeah, but and why I'm sharing it is hopefully someone goes, oh, those things that he's just said ring true to me also. Yeah. And maybe I'm not dealing with it in the way that I should. I guess, yeah, I just wanted to bring that up rather than necessarily talking about my month artistically. I thought it was a wonderful opportunity to share a little bit about that, and hopefully it brings awareness. And if there's any signs that you may feel on the spectrum of anxiety, especially at the moment, then please contact Lifeline. How do we bring it back from that?
Wow. Well, that, I mean, that's a really interesting question, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a great opportunity to sit down and talk about where we're at.
Mm.
And we're about to go into an interview touching on the things that we love doing most.
Yeah.
And why we love doing them. We're about to talk to Buddy Miller, who is an amazing individual. We won't tell you about him because you're about to hear from the man himself. And I think that interview is a reminder of the importance of connecting to each other and reaching out and stuff. So I think that's a perfect segue.
Beautiful. Well, here's the interview.
We are here today with Buddy Miller, an actor, a UNESCO-designated teacher of mask work and a ceremonial Balinese mask dancer, previously the head of voice and speech at LaSalle College of the Arts in Singapore, and now senior lecturer, head of acting at the Victorian College of the Arts, University of Melbourne.
Thanks for joining us, Buddy. That's quite a title.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, you know what we'd like to do to start off this particular interview is hear a little bit about your most inspired moment as an artist. Do you care to share?
Sure. My most inspired moment as an artist happened during 9/11. I was performing at a high school in Queens. There was a new book that had come out that was basically archiving the population of Queens, and at the time there was pretty much a representation of the entire world in Queens. This book, Crossing the Boulevard, Strangers, Neighbors, Aliens, and a New America, this woman by the name of Judith Sloan, she was the one who did the ethnography research on it and created this book and did interviews with these different people, and she hired me to perform with her to basically portray these different people of Queens. And we were at this high school in Queens, right next to the Queensborough Bridge, and we had two performances where we were performing these characters. And during the interval of between the first show and the second show, we were told that the World Trade Center was bombed. And that's what they were saying at the time. It was before like we actually knew what really happened. They were saying it was bombed.
Yeah.
And they didn't know what to do with the students. So they said that we had to go back on stage and perform so they could figure out how to take care of the students while we were performing. And it was pretty intense.
Yeah.
We were backstage, and it was, you know, it wasn't a real backstage. It was just like a curtain and like a little small little corridor for us to just basically just prepare for the next show. Because it was a, you know, high school stage. And I have a friend, a childhood friend, who worked at Windows on the World, which was a very famous restaurant that was the top of Tower 1, which is no longer there. So that was very scary for me. And Judith was just like hysterical. And I was like, we actually have to go out there and perform.
Yeah.
So they opened the curtains. We went out on stage. And I had just had this moment where I was working on my first monologue. And I looked out into the audience. And I saw these kids looking up at me. And they were focused and very concentrated on what was happening on stage, and I had this moment where I was like, I remember what it was like to be those kids in the audience, and wanting to be on stage and wanting to be a performer, and something in me shifted. There was this feeling of incredible humility where I realized that it's not about me, that, you know, what I do on stage, what I do as an artist, and what I do as a performer, and even as a teacher, it's not about me. It's something bigger than me. And it was just like that shift, and then I was able to do the show. And then we did the show, and then it was chaos after that. It looked the hallways were just like you saw in the movies, people screaming and running and no one knowing what was going on. And I walk outside and I look at the Queensborough Bridge, and it's filled with thousands of people walking across the bridge because all the subways were turned off.
So like that day, as an artist, as a person, it's intense, like no words.
Thank you so much
for sharing.
For sharing that story. In a story, any kind of story, a film or a play or a spoken word, whatever it is, what is it that you think that an audience should take away with them from a performance?
Well, I firmly believe that our jobs as artists is to get people to think and get them to feel and to show them who they are, to show people their human potential, whether it be a hero or a villain. And in order for an audience member to fully experience that, it requires an artist to sacrifice a bit of their body and their ego into the transformation that the character's asking of them. And something happens. It creates a vibration in the space, and the audience walks away with that. And so what about, what's the most vital piece of art that you've seen as an audience member?
Is it, are you talking about a performance that I've seen?
Is there one in
particular? Or a piece of art.
Oh, okay. So in theatre, there have been some performances that have moved me deeply. Robert Wilson's Einstein on the Beach. What is Arya Mnuchin's piece? The piece on... It was all about what was happening in Europe and the refugees that were trying to travel to Australia and dealing with the immigration and also the passage through the tunnel between France and England. But there was something that happened in that was just extraordinary that happened in my memory. And then also Complicité's Schunken. Those three seminal works for me are really important. Robert Wilson's six-hour collaboration with Philip Glass and Einstein on the Beach just was, it's a feat of extraordinary brilliance and specificity and the power of the imagination and the power of the voice and the body and what human beings are capable of doing, the kind of concentration that human beings are capable of doing to take you in a way into an experience where your brain softens and then you begin to go into your subconscious and receive the whole production. And then you deal with Mnuchin's, the memory that happened to me was I left the performance and I was like, I couldn't talk about it. Like, it wasn't like it was one of those kind of performances where, like, I like this, I like that. I was just kind of speechless.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, like, speechless because it was like, oh, my God, it's fucking amazing. It was just like, I was just speechless because it was examples. There were, like, example after example after example. It wasn't fully dramatic. It was just example after example and fully embodied, once again, with the voices and their imagination and use of space. And then I was in Bali.
I love this.
And I was talking to my colleague, Steve Wong, his wife, Suzanne Sheridan. And we were in the car, and we were on a trip to, I think, to a rice paddy, the group. And Suzanne asked me, so have you seen any theater lately? And I said, yeah, you know, I saw Mnuchin's piece just before we left New York. And then I started telling her about it. And as I'm telling her about it, I start weeping. Like, my whole body just starts shaking. And I'm trying to get this story through about this image that she had created about this person trying to communicate to this translator. As we're watching this translator trying to communicate with this person, and behind the translator are these like Australian like racists like laughing and making fun of this poor person that we only see in a computer screen. And there, I mean, it changed me, this memory
in that moment.
In that particular moment, I was telling her about, and that's when the art hit me.
Yeah.
But then when I'm watching Complicité's Schunken and watching a Bunraku puppet turn into a human being seamlessly and not remembering when it was a puppet and when it was a human being, I lost it. I just lose it. It's where the full body is engaged, and so much so that my imagination comes into play, where I'm not being seduced by the psychology of something, but like I'm seeing this creature on stage, this human being doing things that makes me remember what the possibilities of
very visceral
to be alive. Those are the theater moments for me that
you've answered that question quite well. Tick, I like that. But that's, it sounds like these moments that you have, and I think we've all been there, like hearing you talk about that just then. We've all had that moment where we've come out of a piece of theater or whatever it might be, where we've felt like we don't know what to say, like we're still comprehending it or whatever it is that's happening. But also that moment where you get slapped in the face by a piece of art, like the way that you talk about it hitting you is really a powerful image, isn't it?
You make me think of another piece that's really, really important to me. It's the Soho Rep when they did Sarah Kane's Blasted. And that shook me. It shook me because these actors just went there. And the designers just went there. And the company just went
complete
there.
Effort.
And because they own the space, there were things that they could do with the space.
You can't normally.
So they were like, they were literally ripping the floorboards from the theater.
That's amazing.
And Ian climbs down into the floorboards and his head's coming out. I mean, and the commitment that these actors had to that work was just, it changed my life. And when they were done, they just stood there And we were all just like, we didn't even know if we could clap because it was like everyone was just blasted. We were just blasted. So I highly recommend anyone going to the New York Performance Library and watching that performance.
So, okay, let's move on to, I mean, you're an African-American man and you've spent a large amount of time training and teaching and living in Asia.
Yeah.
And now you're here in Australia.
Now I'm in Australia, mate.
Yeah. Yeah. Welcome.
Thank you.
How important do you think the exposure to different cultures has been on your identity, your voice, and you as a complete artist?
Oh, that's an interesting nugget. I have an amazing mother who was always like, I don't care what you do, just as long as you're the best at it. Yeah. So I spent a lot of my time being the best at things, right? And then when I wasn't the best at it, I just was like, okay, it's not for me. That's not my thing. But it actually helped me. It helped me on so many levels because it made me explore things the way that I wanted to explore them. I was never forced by my mother to do anything other than be happy. And so she, in her way, taught me in a just in a Eckhart Tolle kind of way of, or Joseph Campbell kind of way of following my bliss, you know. Mm. And my father was a different scenario. My father wanted me to be an architect. He wanted me to follow in his footsteps. He wanted me to be heterosexual. He wanted so many things. But I was fortunate enough to be a child of young parents. My mom was 19. My dad was 20.
Ah, right.
You know, because in the 70s, that's what you did. You graduated high school and you had kids.
Yeah.
You know, and so I had very young parents.
So more liberal worldview.
I think, you know, they basically came together so they could have me because after five years, they got a divorce and I was a latchkey kid for a long time. And because of the support that I had from my mother, my grandparents were very good at, you know, my grandfather was really my guiding force on just whenever I needed advice about parently advice and, you know, about what career I wanted to go into or education or anything like that, I would just go to my grandfather. And my mom and my grandmother were always there to support me and push me forward. When I would do things, for example, move to California at 19 years old and go to school in Paris at 23 years old and move to New York at 25, 26 years old, going to NYU and going to Bali and going to Asia. My mom was always like, go, do it. You live your life. And there was a point when I was moving to Asia and I was like, Mom, I think I'm going to get a job in Singapore. And I'm going to be so far away from the family. She's like, you don't worry about the family. You go and you live your life. If they want to see you, they'll come see you. You go live your life. And she's been like that, even with religion. Because in an African-American culture, like, religion is such a strong, has a strong hold on so many people. And my mom, this is a funny story. So, like, so I was growing up, and my classmates were, like, you know, getting bar mitzvahed and catechismed and kinsiyatad and all whatever, you know. And I was like, what is this thing? And then my neighbor was like, you haven't been baptized? Oh, my God, you're going to go to hell. It's like, I think I was around 12 years old. It's my God, I'm going to go to hell. So I went to my mom and said, I'm going to go to hell. I haven't been baptized.
What have you done to me?
Yeah. And she's like, you want to go get baptized? Go get baptized. That's not my problem. You decide if you want to get baptized? Go get baptized. So my uncle was in AA at the time, which has a very good link to the church. And so he was going to the church all the time. And I was like, I need to get baptized. And he said, okay, we'll get you baptized. And so me, I've always been like very dramatic. So
no. I'm going to wear
a hijab. Some things never change. Some perfections never die. So I'm totally like thinking that like I'm going to be like in this white robe and this big, beautiful church, and the priest is going to be in this pool with me, and I'm dipped, and I'm gonna have this moment of, you know, where I'm going to meet God and
ascension.
I'm going to be saved.
Yeah, you know?
So I get to the church, and we don't go inside the church. We go to the side alley of the church, and there's this baby pool on the side of the church, and it's a baby pool. And I've always been a very particular kid. I was like, "What is this? What is this? This is so ghetto." I'm like, "Oh my God, I'm gonna die!" And so, like, I'm looking, and then
how
like,
old are you? 12.
12. 12.
Yeah.
I was a drama queen even then.
Yeah.
So then, like, there's other people that were getting baptized before me, and they're like, they dipped them into the water, and then the person got dipped in the water, like, they start speaking in tongues, like, humana, 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 humana. I was like, and I'm looking at this, going, "What is this?" And so then it's my turn, and I was like, "Fuck, So I got pressured into speaking into tongues. So I got dipped backwards into this water, and I'm like, humming, 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 humming. And like, he's feeling it. I'm mortified. I'm embarrassed. This is so stupid. And so, like, then I get home, my mom says, so how was your baptism? I was like, I'm so dumb. She goes, I told you, but you wanted to go get baptized.
Yeah, you need
so
to go get baptized. That, right.
And I think because of those kind of, like, there's no taboos around those things, I was free enough to go and explore the Asian cultures and also explore the Hinduism and be interested in Hinduism with that kind of freedom.
We'll be back shortly with the interview.
Okay, so this is our little practical information segment for the podcast that each month we try to think of something that is pertinent to our lives and careers that we think might be helpful to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And we threw around a few ideas this month, and I think you came up with this one, Nick.
Oh, thank you. I'll take it.
The challenge was to write a piece of poetry around nourishing yourself as an artist.
We did. Look, I don't know what to expect out of this. Hopefully there'll be some practical tips for you, the listener. Or maybe it's just purely entertainment. However, I would like to start by being the gentleman and offering Lauren Bailey that the lady goes first.
I just think it's so funny because when we thought of this idea, we were really excited. We were like, that will be hilarious. And I'm like, I'm going to write comedy. It's going to be great. And recently I was lucky enough to see Puerto Rican spoken word poet Ovius Maximus. He's from New York, and he was here recently to perform. I think he did a few shows in Melbourne and Sydney. Anyway, he's amazing. He's a Grand Slam poetry champion. And so, I thought I would like channel.
Yeah, you're inspired by him.
Yeah, I was like, right, I'm going to channel a little bit of this. And this is my first attempt at slam poetry.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. Wow, you did a lot more research and preparation for this. So let's, okay, everyone, here we go.
And so this was meant to be a comedy.
Okay.
It's meant to be sort of me being a bit.
Take it with a grain of salt. Okay.
And
do you need a beat, or are you happy to just?
No, that's okay. And great. I guess I'm just amazed at how nervous this is making me feel. So let's go. When life is good and I'm on track, I feel alive and I just want to share the joy. But other times I feel like I'm searching for surcease, some kind of relief, a way to go easy but still believe that life is an ocean. And if I play my cards, I might just catch a wave. As a performer, there's a pressure to behave. But perhaps the pressure is only mine. I'm the only one that can hold myself accountable, push myself forward or pull myself down. And if I'm going to take care of myself, of everyone, it's important to remember that little things like breathing help. Bigger things like smiling connect me to the people and the world around me. To give myself nourishment or some kind of personal encouragement, in the middle of the year and the winter and the whirlwind of life, I try to just let myself be easy on myself, get back in my body, hug my friends and help when I can, and understand that often when I feel like I'm struggling to find the right thing to say or the best comment to impress, that I'm actually protecting myself. And if I want to be good to myself, then instead of protecting, I should be opening, should be giving myself the sensation of being limitless. And if I want to nourish myself as an artist, then the answer is right there in itself. Create art.
That was great.
Yeah, it's hilarious. Piece of hilarity.
That was beautiful, though. I loved it. Create art. That's the name of the piece, is it right?
Didn't have a name. And I do need to actually credit a friend of mine who is a musician and who's performing this weekend in Sydney at Frankie's, the Ivory Elephants, performing at Frankie's. Anyway, in the kitchen at work the other day, I said, what do you do to nourish yourself as an artist? And he said, what do you mean? And he said that. I was like, oh my God,
that's it.
That's amazing. That's what we do. Like, that's how we heal ourselves. And
I love that. That was, do you know what? You are going to be so underwhelmed by what I have to offer you.
I'm sure I won't be.
All right, listeners. That was kind of the nice piece of art that you heard, the spoken word poetry from Lauren Bailey. This is comic relief. I've got two little numbers for you here.
Awesome.
I can't believe I'm doing this.
Do they have... I know, it's amazing how nervous they are.
Yeah.
Do they have titles?
So I'm going to call one The Young Man from Nantucket. And the other one, The Young Man from Kundruk. Let's start with Nantucket. Are you ready for this? Just remember, this is the comic relief.
This is already nourishing me, Nick, okay. For what that's worth.
Okay, some quiet now, please, for my serious artistic pursuits. There was a young man from Nantucket. Angry tears he cried in a bucket. His head was a mess until he learned to care less, and now he just utters, "Ah, fuck it." So that was one.
That is brilliant.
I'm not sure the message there.
That's pretty much what I said, right?
Well, that's pretty much what you said. Just create art. Okay, here's the second piece of amazing artistry. There once was a man from Kundruk. When his acting was slow, he did sook. But instead of a frown, a beer he chugged down and curled up alone with a book.
Oh.
So I think the message there is... nourish yourself with a beer and a book. Well, no, you know, I think we can agree that poetry wasn't my forte there, but...
But you suggested it.
Well, I did suggest it, and I completely regret suggesting it now.
Anyway, we hope you guys got something from that. So you're not only a ceremonial Balinese mask dancer, but have also been developing actor training in Bali over the last decade?
Yes.
Where I have been lucky enough to train and work with you in recent years.
Yes. Your work, many years.
Your work there focuses on taksu, which yes. you define as the moment an artist surrenders to their craft and God appears.
Mm.
This idea of a divine energy has many different names across the globe, including the Indian terminology rasa and the American sporting concept of being in the zone. Can you tell us about why you think this universal search for the divine is so important within performance work and why you feel such a strong connection to the Balinese culture and its beliefs around the human condition and performance?
I think it's always been what people have searched for. I don't think it's a new concept to search for a spiritual connection in art. I think that's the nature of art. And I think as artists, we are constantly looking and searching for something greater than ourselves because we've had an experience in a big piece of art, so whether it be theater or a painting or... being walking inside of a cathedral and being moved by an architectural space. But the reason why I'm so drawn to the Balinese is I feel that they have a clear way of manifesting it and honing that energy and activating the embers of taksu inside of the human being without fear, but with the celebration that's so deeply embedded inside of their culture and their religion. They spend... every day praying to taksu. That's part of the daily prayer, to pray for something divine, for the connections that you have with art, with space, with nature, with each other as a divine experience. So they believe that being kind to the nature and to human beings is a prayer in itself.
In Western societies, generally the idea of the divine seems to take a bit of a back seat these days.
Well, I think it's because of religion.
Religion?
Like what we were talking about just a few minutes ago. Like it's like it gets tainted by institutionalized religion and the separatism that many religions say, my religion versus your religion. And it's like, it's all. That's why I think I like Hinduism so much, is because it just says everything is there. God is in everything. You know, and the stories are just so fabulous.
Yeah.
You know, and I would even say that it's not what the Americans call the zone, this taksu energy. It's really a vibration. The best way to think of it is how the Balinese look at it. So you have Lord Shiva in heaven with Brahma and Vishnu. So Shiva is the destroyer, Vishnu is the regulator, and Brahma is the creator, the three gods, the three major Hindu gods.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, they have avatars.
Yeah, yeah.
But the three main guys, right, that are up there keeping heaven in order. Shiva decides to leave heaven and go check out earth and be with the mortals. And he's gone for too long, and Brahma and Vishnu are like, we need to get Shiva back. But they know that if they go directly to Shiva, that he'll just hide. But they also know that Shiva cannot avoid really good art. Like, Like Shiva just goes crazy for it. They know that if we do a performance, let's do a mask dance. We'll perform. We'll do these, make some beautiful masks. They'll do a mask performance, and hopefully it'll be good enough that Shiva will come in and visit.
Yeah.
So they do their mask performance, and all of a sudden Shiva pokes his head up. He goes, What's going on? What's that? And so the Balinese believe that when you feel this energy, this divine energy, it's Lord Shiva actually coming in to look at your performance.
It's a wonderful way to look at it, isn't it?
Mm.
Gives you goosebumps too.
Beautiful. So you're currently in your first year of an appointment as the senior lecturer head of acting at the BCA here in Melbourne.
Yeah.
An institution that's committed to providing transformative learning experiences in pursuit of artistic excellence. What made you consider the Australian industry as the next step in your creative journey?
Mm.
I've been coming and going through Australia and Southeast Asia for quite some time now. For the past 16 years, I've been coming and going through this world. And I was moving through Australia before Singapore. So I had friends and colleagues. And I performed actually performed in Brisbane at the Powerhouse.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Mask dancing?
No, it was a play. It was a play called, it was with Margie Brown Ash. She directed it. A Mouthful of Pins with the Nest Theatre Company. They were developing the work in Bali, and then while working with me as a teacher, they were like, we want you to be a part of this performance. And at the time, I had some love interest in Australia. And she's like,
plural.
And Margie was like, if you come to Australia, you'll get to meet that boy more and you get to really get to know him. I was like, So like I said, it's always about a man.
Yeah.
No, but that's why I ended up coming to Australia. And then I was moved by these women and working with these women. And Margie had created a perspective of looking at performance in a different way for me. And Leah Mercer and her writing and her generosity and with the process of developing the script, and Scotia Mankovic, who I performed with, it was just one of these really exciting moments for a performer. And it was in Australia, mate.
Yeah, well, see, that's interesting too, because, I mean, we have our own ideas on what Australian storytelling culture is. And that was probably your first taste of the Australian storytelling culture, right? But I guess from an outsider's perspective, and you're now, I feel like we can almost call you an insider, but at the moment, now.
Almost.
I'm working on it. Please. Give me another shot.
Yeah, but I mean, from that perspective that you have right now, your impression of the arts industry here, is there something that you feel like makes us unique? Is there something that particular style that makes us who we are that you have found since being here?
I have a very skewed perspective.
Yeah.
What I was seeing when I was in Brisbane 9 years ago, that was 9 years ago.
Yeah.
9, 10 years ago. And what I'm seeing in Melbourne now, the reason why I think that it's good to have me here is because I come in with this magpie perspective of how to make art. It all depends on who's in front of me. What do you need? Okay, you need to work on your voice. Okay, you need to work on your body. You need to work on specificity. You need to work on your objectives. You need to work on your transformation. You need to work using an image to transform into a character. But I think what I've been seeing is that there's almost an island perspective going on here where it's all about the big finish.
Right.
Interesting, weird stuff, and then a big finish, and then interesting, weird stuff, and then a big finish. And it's like the dramaturgy of a lot of the work that I see here is similar. The connection to the breath and the voices is held. And I just think that because of the work ethic here, what I can offer is just a deeper entrance into what you're already doing.
Yeah.
That's kind of like how I look at it. And you guys desperately need to have more theater that mirrors your community.
Yeah.
There's not enough people of color on stage. I'm tired of seeing all these white ideas, these white people stories for white people. And because when I first applied for the position here at VCA, the first thing I did was I did a Google search of Faces of Australia. And I found, and the first image that came up was this like multicultural image. And I was like, whoa, there's black people in this, in Melbourne? Okay. And then I looked at the graduates of ECA, and it was like one Indian girl and the rest were white people. Mm. And it's like it doesn't reflect the community.
It does happen, and you know, stage TV, film.
Yeah.
I think it's across the board at the
moment.
It's
across the board.
Yeah.
And I was talking to an agent just recently, and she's like, you know, Booty, like, I have this fabulous African-American actress, but when I get a casting, they want me to sit in a casting for a family.
Mm.
They want a white family. But I have this great actor that could do this, this work. And I think things are happening in the world where I think Australia can tag on to this idea of really making the theater, the images that people see, representative of the citizens.
Mm.
You know, and that's one of my big missions here, is to create an environment for students to be citizens of the theater community and the industry here, and create stories that people are interested in.
And so a young artist starting out today, or trying to decide if they're brave enough to commit to a life in art, or if this is the right path for them, what would your advice to them be?
There is a place for you.
That's simple.
Plain and simple.
So there is always a place for you because you are who you
unique
are.
Unique and who you are. You know, there's a place for you. There's a place for your voice, and there's a place for you. And if people don't want to hear it, you make it. You make it heard. Listen to that inner voice. If you know that you are supposed to be an artist, there's no one that can stop you from that. What I'm saying is not easy, but it's definitely one of the most interesting careers you can take. And we're incredibly lucky, because the advantage of becoming an artist is you get to reflect on yourself as a human being, and how you position yourself in the world. And when you are interpreting a character, you get to go through the psyche of someone else and have a little bit more humility about the world and about human nature. And I think that the more artists we have out there, the better, you know. And you may not make any money for a while, but as long as you are connecting to something that is driving your bliss, that's all that really matters.
Love that.
Just before you left Singapore, your theatre company, Theatre of Others, that you run with co-artistic director Adam Marple, produced an intimate production of Hamlet.
I did watch an interview with you on this particular production.
Oh, you did?
Yes. Oh. We do our research here. Watch out. So, and you played Hamlet.
I did play Hamlet.
Yeah. And the production itself was complete, like, it was experiential, it was out of the box.
Yeah,
it wasn't in a black box theater.
Yeah, it was in a two-story penthouse suite. Yeah.
And you played multiple characters,
didn't
you?
I played
Hamlet and the Ghost.
So take us through it. Like, what was that production like as an experience for you personally?
Well, a lot of things happened with that. It's really important for anyone who teaches acting to be an actor and put themselves in that space. Because we can tend to forget what it takes to do the job. And the kind of vulnerability that happens to us as actors when we're in the work and when we're performing for an audience. And that was one thing that was really exciting. The other thing that was interesting was that in the performance, one of my new VCA students was in the audience, because her best friend is one of my students in Singapore. So she came to the performance. And so, like, afterwards, she's like there, and I'm like, oh, okay, well, this is what you're going to get.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
This is me.
And, you know, and it was incredibly vulnerable. I was wow. Okay, well, that's that, you know.
It's sometimes the hard thing. We have spoken to Gabby Rose Carter about this too, around marrying the actor with the teacher. Mm-hmm. It's sometimes a very fine line, and the vulnerabilities that come with that as well, of having the teacher.
Yeah, because the other thing is, like, I cast two of the three characters that I cast in the show were former students. And when I'm working with them, I'm working with them as a fellow actor, not as a teacher.
Yeah.
You know, so they do their thing. Whatever their thing is, it's not about me teaching them to do their thing.
Yeah.
That's also very exciting for me to see them go and do their work. And the ones that really hit the mark, and the ones that, you know, fell over at the wayside, you know, that's
what it is.
Yeah, and I remember.
You were, back in the day, acting coach for Michelle Williams.
Yeah.
Yeah. In her Academy Award-nominated performance for Brokeback Mountain.
Yes.
Sorry.
Brokeback Mountain.
The film, directed by Ang Lee, depicts the complex emotional and homosexual relationship between two cowboys in the American West. And Williams played one of the cowboys' longtime fiancés, Alma Beers. The film depicts her struggle to come to terms with her fiancé, not only loving another person, but also a man, in a society that wasn't accepting of such a relationship. This film was actually banned from any cinemas across Australia at the time.
Was it really?
It was. Yes, you could only watch it in art house cinemas.
Whoa.
And as I'm sure you're aware, we have not yet reached marriage equality in Australia.
Yeah, I am aware of that.
As a proudly gay man, what
I'm queer
and proud.
What does this film represent to you? The experience of working on it as well, and how do you feel it affected the society of the time?
This is the thing, like, at that time, when I was working working on that with Michelle, it wasn't actually a flag waver. It really wasn't. Like, yeah. And then when it got all of its kudos, it was like, oh, people are actually responding to this. Okay, great. As a queer person, I'm like, these are all heterosexual people.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's still, you know what I mean? It's still heteronormative in that sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when for me, it was like, well, this is really great that, you know, this story is being told, but it's still all... I think for me, when we look at Moonlight, that's the kind of work that I get moved by because I forgot that it was a gay story. Yeah. I actually literally forgot that it was a queer story until someone told me, like, I was like, it's so cool that Moonlight, like, won because it's a... And they're like, yeah, it's queer, too. It's like... Oh, yeah, that's right. It was, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't think about it in those terms at all.
I don't at all. I look at it as male intimacy.
But this was the thing, I think, for Brokeback Mountain at the time, and I distinctly remember having to go to an art house cinema to watch this. It was a step, I feel, in the
huge.
Right direction.
It was a huge
You know
step
what I mean?
Right
because it was kind of like, why do I have to go here to watch this film?
Yeah,
but
exactly.
But society, especially Australian society at the time, because I remember the media around it, wasn't ready for anything more than that.
Yeah.
That was, it came at the right time to then push things forward.
Well, I think this is what I was talking about before, like why we need to continue to allow a community that can tell their stories. And Melbourne is a great place for that. I have friends that are telling me that they're looking for more ethnic actors and they can't find ones that are trained well enough, you know, and or that are out there in the industry. And it's like, but they want to create a more diverse community and casting. Mm-hmm. So it's like the desire is there. Now it's time to actually officially institutionalize it.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm here.
Make it work.
Fantastic. And what was it like working with Michelle on this project?
I was fortunate to work on this film from an acting coach perspective. So I had a studio in Brooklyn called Studio 5, and I was known for a very particular way of working. And it's just so funny because you don't think of like yourself. I didn't think of myself as like, you know, having any kind of clout in the industry. I just was doing my thing.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I pretty much have always been like that. I think that's kind of helped me out because I think I'm good, but like I don't think I'm as good as like other people think I am. And so it like helps me out. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And so Michelle had called this place called the Actor Center, where it still exists. It's a place where master teachers train actors, and a lot of high level actors go there for their training. And there's a company called the Workshop Company that is very seasoned actors. It's an opportunity for them to when they're not working to stay and keep refining their skills. And so she called the Actor Center and told them that what she was looking for. And they sent her to me. Okay, so I'm like, I'm walking on the street going home. I get this phone call with the phone number that I don't recognize. I answer it, and she's like, "Hi, I'm looking for an acting coach." I was like, "Okay," because you know that was my bread and butter at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's like, "Yeah, I just got cast in this Ang Lee movie," and I'm so dizzy. I'm so dizzy about these kind of things. I was like, "Oh man, this will be really good for you. That'll be really good for you. Wow, Ang Lee. That's a very good. He's a very good director.
This will be a great step up.
Yeah, this will be good for you. Yeah, exactly." Yeah. So she's like, "Well, you know,
this could be your big break."
Yeah, that's exactly how I was talking, right? Like totally. And so I'm like, you know. She's like, I've been working in the industry, but I don't have any formal training, and I'm looking for someone to help me get some techniques just so that when it's time for me to turn on, that I can turn on and be consistent and be in my body and my voice. Yeah. So, oh, yeah, I can help you do that.
Yeah.
Why don't we just do one session, you know, and you can see if you like what I do, and then we'll go from there. She goes, okay, we'll do that. And I say, okay, cool, whatever. I don't think I'm such a dizzy broad when it comes to these kind of things. So, like, whatever, you know. And so I look out, and it's like 15 minutes before the session begins. I look out, because I had the whole third floor. I had, like, a loft space that was two spaces, and it was, like, 7,000 square feet. Like, one half was my home and the other half was my studio. and I looked out of the window and I saw her standing across the street waiting for her time. It was like 15 minutes early. She's a beautiful woman. Yeah. She's a beautiful woman. Yeah. So humble. Oh. So she's standing out across the street and just waiting for her time. And then then the time comes, and she comes up, and we work, and she's like, this is exactly what I'm looking for. And I'm still don't put anything together. And I'm calling her Melissa, and she's saying, my name is Michelle. Michelle, okay, Michelle. It's like, she, I was like, okay, so why don't you, like, I could have the agency send over the script so we could work. I said, yeah, we'll do 10 sessions, you know.
Yeah.
She's like, yeah, okay. And I said, just have the agency send over the script. She's like, okay, cool. And I get this, like, delivery from Gersh. And I was like, oh, wow, she's with Gersh. It's a really good agency. She's doing really well. She's doing well. I'm still, because I never watched Dawson's Creek. So I have no idea what's going on, right? So then we work, and we're working. And she's doing some beautiful work. And we worked on the moment where she's looking out, and she sees Enos, like, kissing. Mm. And that moment, like, I said to her, I said, you know, this whole film revolves around you, really. We have to believe that you believe that he would never do something like this.
Yeah.
It's through you that we get the heartbreak.
Yeah.
So if we don't feel it from you, then the film's not going to work.
Yeah.
And I have actually had the script that I worked with at my mom's house. Like, mm-hmm. My mom has it. Like, and like, you can see all the different moments that we worked on in the studio. But the thing that was really important, I think, with that whole interaction was when she walked in the room the very first time, there was something there. Like, there was this energy, there was this vulnerability, there was this presence that she had when she walked into the room. And I was like, why don't my actors have that? And from that point on was when that's what began my research and finding presence in my actors to get that quality out of them. Because I was like, what is that? Because that's something different. That's not what my actors are walking in. And I really believe that's because she had a career at a very young age where she was trained to keep that vulnerability open for herself so that she didn't know how to shut it down.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So she would enter into a space with this very open, in a Brené Brown kind of way, vulnerable space.
Yeah. I love the fact you keep using the word vulnerability, because my next question is exactly about that. But I want to turn it back to you as far as your most vulnerable moment as a teacher or as an artist. Do you remember it? And what did you take away from it?
Well, I think these days I'm constantly touching my vulnerability a lot. A lot. But vulnerability, for me, it's an interesting question because I find that I'm constantly grappling with my vulnerability because as it reveals itself to me or rears its head, I don't recognize it, because if it's vulnerable, it's usually a place that I don't. It's not something that's held. It's not something that's blocked. It's not something that's controlled or manipulated. It's really vulnerable and very truthful, and I don't recognize it. And because I don't recognize it, and I don't have any strategies to fix it or cover it.
Yeah.
And it's there's this kind of almost hangover residue that comes after it, going,
yeah.
So what do I do with it? What do I do with that feeling? And I know that because of where I am now that it's part of the work, but it's something that I would like to offer to those that are exploring their own vulnerability, that it's never going to look like how you expect it. And what I've learned, that every single time that I've been vulnerable, it's been it's fed into something bigger than me.
Mm-hmm.
And that people respond to me in a way that I never expected them to. And they actually get closer to me. They get more. Yeah. They want to be around me more. They want to learn from me because this is why I say that you have to, if you're going to be teaching, if you're teaching acting, that you have to be an actor yourself. If you're teaching vulnerability in your work, you have to be vulnerable yourself. Mm-hmm. And I tell my students that I will never ask you to do something that I'm not willing to do myself.
I think that's it.
Yeah. Buddy, thank you so much for your time.
It has been fantastic.
Thank you.
Thanks,
guys.
And here we are on the other side of another amazing interview.
Amazing. Yes. What do you have to take out so I'm speechless?
It's really interesting sitting down to chat to Buddy, because obviously I've worked with him before.
Yes, yes.
And I think he's an amazing teacher.
Quite a few times,
and artist.
Really.
But when he was talking about his experience working with Michelle Williams and the moment when she walked in the room, that
yes,
there was something about her energy, her vulnerability and her presence that was really alive, and that was something that his other actors didn't have. And I feel like you hear this through media channels and stories from people in the industry, this idea of an artist who has this thing. Mm. There was that thing about her.
Yeah.
And on some days in winter or when you're feeling insular, it can be hard to listen to people who talk about other artists having some unattainable quality that...
Well, that's uniquely theirs.
...separates them and propels them in their careers.
Yep.
What I love is that this thing, this energy that Michelle had, actually compelled Budi to find a way to discover presence in all of his actors, that this uniqueness is not unattainable. It's inside all of us, and we just need to find a way to be present with it.
That's right.
And so we talked to Budi about, you know, what he would say to a young artist, and this to me beautifully provides the balance that there is, he said, there's a place for you.
Yeah.
And if there isn't a place for you, then create it.
Yeah, I totally agree with
that. I'm not sure how I'm going to feed that into my month.
Yeah.
But talking about this idea of creating a place for yourself as an artist, I have already mentioned the classes I'm doing with Chad. I'm also about to start Chinese pole classes with Anne Chung.
The lovely Anne Chung.
Yep.
I have to say her name like that as a complete the lovely Anne Chung.
Well, she's just okay.
So great. She's okay. Fantastic.
And the other exciting thing that will be happening is I am just heading back into rehearsals for a show that I'm in September.
This is exciting.
Baggage Productions.
Yes.
It's a zombie comedy.
Love it. Love it already.
Called Anno Zombie. And yeah, we start tomorrow afternoon. So.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Very exciting stuff. Are we in alignment, or, you know,
yeah.
I don't know. How do you feel about that? What did you take away from?
Well, I got all of that. I like what you said. Don't get me wrong. But I also took out this idea of Budi said about the freedom to explore if we take away the taboos in life. And, you know, he was particularly speaking about
the baptism.
Yeah. But I feel it's particularly pertinent for me this month and what I was speaking about in the front of this podcast around anxiety and the taboo around anxiety.
And us not being able to talk about mental health.
Well, that's right. And I think we are getting better generally at speaking about mental health. But when you think about the amount of people, I was using that figure around 10%, 2 million Australians that suffer from anxiety. We should be talking about it more, and there shouldn't be a taboo around it. And hopefully, to quote Budi again, this idea of the brain softens, like art is a thing that will help us talk about it. If you see good art, it softens the brain, you know, and it lets other ideas come in.
Yeah.
Open
stuff. About changing, impacting the world.
Impacting the world. So I think that's what I took out of Budi's interview. Do you know what? I was going to share this quote, and I think you've summarized this quite well. It's from a guest that we're going to have in a couple of months, a wonderful, wonderful parkour artist named Ali Kadim. So parkour, I think, first of all, really quickly, is basically a movement art that uses the streets. Please look it up, Google it. I won't get caught in the definition of parkour right now.
People who jump off buildings onto other buildings.
Pretty much is the best way to describe it.
That's how I described it to someone the other day, which is probably not 100% accurate, but it'll do.
It is what it is. And so he posted this on Facebook recently, and it was about parkour, but I think it relates to what you've been speaking about, which is really about connecting with you, essentially, and giving yourself the time to connect with you. And he's put here, parkour is really about you connecting with you, your mind, your body, your spirit, your progress. It is a search for truth and freedom, a feeling that's hard to describe, but a real one for those who have felt it. We each face a million daily obstacles, challenges, distractions, everything. But if we take the time to reconnect with our deeper selves, we may find our real passion, our truth, our power. And that's a good path to take.
Wow.
Yeah.
I know they're Ali's words, but...
Yeah. Well, you know...
I needed that.
Sometimes we need to take other people's words and use them. And I hope that I can at least take a tenth of that and place it into my month and the way I think about my month.
Well, exciting times. And of course... We will be back next month with, we have another fantastic podcast guest, Chum Ahelapala, and he is a teacher, an actor, just a great individual.
Changemaker extraordinaire. So we look forward to bringing you that podcast.
And until then, you can, of course, follow us on iTunes and SoundCloud, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram.
All of that. And visit the new website, of course.
Which looks pretty damn schmick.
Very schmick indeed. And also, why don't you email us?
Yeah, go on.
theactofstorytelling@gmail.com.
And continue to join us on The Act of Storytelling.
Thanks for listening.